Monsignor l-Arkimandrita ġi ordnat fil-29 ta' Diċembru fl-1959 għandu baċċellerat fil-letteratura u PhD minn Oxford. Arkimandrita huwa Monsignor Mifsud Montanero huwa titlu orientali lill-kleru mhux miżewweġ. Però huwa wkoll tifsira ta' superjur ta' diversi monasteri għalli. Hija dinjità ħanejdu hekk monastika ġifieri li tingħata fl-ambjent tal-monastiċiżmu, tal-irħib, tal-patrijiet. Huwa inkardinat Melkita tal-Galilea f'Iżrael, kien uffiċjal kap tal-istess Knisja u Head of Department għal-Knejjes Orientali fl-Università fil-Vatikan. Fil-2010 sar papas, ġifieri parroku, għax dejjem daħla dil-kelma papas dejjem naf li tiġi missier mill-Greku imma huwa parroku, ġifieri kappillan tal-Greek Catholic Church of Our Lady of Damascus. Monsignor Mifsud Montanaro ħadem fil-Marok, fil-Iżrael, fil-Vatikan u fil-Franza. Kien seminarist, kien direttur tas-seminaristi fil-Russikum f'Ruma u 30 sena direttur spirituali tal-Kolleġġo Greko f'Ruma fil-Pontificio Kolleġġo Santa Tanasio. Jifri JSV ħajja abbastanza movimentata, impenjata u nirringrazzja ħafna li oġbu jil-qadin l-istedina tagħna l-lejla se jitkellem bl-Ingliż u xekketli. Nagħti l-kelma lill-Monsignor Arkimandrita.
Nirringrazzjakom għall-istedina. Għandu ħsieb nitkellem fuq il-dokument konċiljari fuq il-Knejjes Kattoliċi tal-Vant. Dokument jismu Orientalium Ecclesiarum. Se nitkellem bl-Ingliż għax jiġini iktar faċli nikkomponi bl-Ingliż imma naf li din mhix diffikolta għalikom. I am happy to be a part of this most useful and timely celebration of the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council and to speak about the conciliar decree on the Eastern Catholic Church's Orientalium Ecclesiarum. My contribution has nothing very original, but perhaps it will stimulate a certain interest in the questions I will refer to and provoke a number of questions. The Vatican II was unlike any other before it. It would be primarily pastoral in its intention and scope, looking inwards for a refreshment of self-understanding and looking outwards to embrace the world. But the Council would offer new theological and spiritual insights on what it means to be church and on the nature of the Church's mission and service to the world. The ingathering of the nations, to use a biblical phrase. Pope John the 23rd described the conciliar event, which was remarkable as an event before being remarkable in the text it promulgated, described the conciliar event as a new Pentecost, causing the Church to open out its inner richness. Among the striking innovations in the Council's proceedings, as has recently been remarked, was the adoption of a new style of approach to persons and problems, one of dialogue and of mercy, but always presupposing a faithful adhesion to authentic doctrine. The Council was to respond to the needs of the present day by demonstrating the validity of the Church's teaching rather than by condemnation. Equally striking was the concern to come to terms with difference, to go beyond the Eurocentrism and the monocentrism that had for the past millennium characterized the Catholic Church. Also remarkably present was the special consideration and solicitude for those not belonging to the Catholic and even the Christian fold. Pope John's plea for renewal and aggiornamento did not imply any reduction of theological rigor, and he had an abounding confidence in the value of the Church's spiritual patrimony, fruit of the Holy Spirit's guidance throughout the centuries. It did not imply any break of continuity with the tradition, capital T, as some critics from the right and from the left would like to affirm. On the contrary, the going back to the sources was a precondition for authentic progress. Thus, the sacred deposit of Christian doctrine was to be guarded and taught more efficaciously, not as a precious relic of antiquity, but as a perennial, life-giving source of life and service. The plunge into tradition, which had such fruitful results, especially in ecclesiology, was also a plunge forward, in which the achievements of modern scholarship, as well as those of the biblical, patristic, liturgical, ecumenical, and other ecclesial movements would be fully exploited. It is significant also that the Council would draw much inspiration not only from the Greek Fathers, but also from contemporary Orthodox thought. From here derive many of the new perceptions in the field of ecclesiology, such as the focusing on the Church as a communion and as a communion of local churches, sister churches, on synodality and subsidiarity, and on the significance of the local church and of the local liturgical assembly. This was the climate in which the conciliar documents were forged, and in which the decree on the Eastern Catholic Churches saw the light of day. The message contained in them is still in the process of being worked out and creatively assimilated by the people of God. This is the process of reception. It is generally considered that the unifying theme of the entire conciliar corpus is that concerning the Church. This found supreme expression in the dogmatic constitution on the Church, Lumen Gentium, which proposed to set forth as clearly as possible her, the Church's, own nature and universal mission. This document was promulgated in the Council's third session on November the 21st, 1964, on the same day as two closely interrelated documents, the decree on the Eastern Catholic Churches Orientalium Ecclesiarum and the decree on ecumenism, Unitatis Redintegratio. These three documents, each with its own characteristics and accents, are very much to be taken together. From the point of view of doctrine, the decree of the Eastern Catholic Churches is in direct dependence on the other two. And from the pastoral point of view, it makes explicit certain vital guiding principles for ordered and balanced church life. We are concerned today with a simple commented presentation of the decree Orientalium Ecclesiarum. It would be wrong to suppose that this decree concerns only Eastern Catholics, even if such a limitation is suggested by the phrasing of its first paragraph. This holy ecumenical synod has a special care for the Eastern Churches. Accordingly, it has decided to set down some guiding principles for these churches in addition to those which refer to the Church Universal. The decree solemnly engages the Catholic Church as a whole, as its own by its opening words. The Catholic Church holds in high esteem the institutions of the Eastern Churches, the liturgical rites, ecclesiastical traditions, and Christian way of life. This declaration may surprise or may seem superfluous, unnecessary. Is it not obvious that all churches within the Catholic Communion, with their own legitimate traditions and ways, are equally to be accorded due respect as sister churches? The fact is that this formulation was subject to hot debate in the Council. Many saw in it a form of paternalism, and others an inappropriate contrast or contraposition between of Catholic Church on one side and Eastern Church on the other. The Greek Melkite Archbishop Neophytos Edelby, however, explained, "This affirmation of principle refers to the Catholic Church itself, to the universal Church, which is neither Western nor Eastern. By its very formulation serves to indicate, however, that in the past things were not correctly done. And very often, due esteem due to the Eastern Churches was conspicuous by its absence. Through the action of ecclesiastical personnel, insufficiently prepared, uninformed on the Eastern Churches, even if they were in good faith. There are many instances from history one can refer to in this connection, not only the Crusades, not only colonialistic period, but many others at the same time. The Council Fathers decided to retain the formulation of principle, no doubt, to make sure that the Church's position was clear and to prevent the repetition of past errors. The paragraph then proceeds to declare the reason for this new appreciation in those churches which are distinguished by the Venerable Antiquity, there is clearly evident the tradition which has come from the Apostles through the Fathers, and which is part of the divinely revealed, undivided heritage of the Universal Church. As you will recall, this tradition is shared, and yet more fully, by those Eastern churches not in full communion with Rome. And in their regard, there is a similar and more developed affirmation in the decree on ecumenism. This was the first time that an ecumenical council of the Catholic Church fully recognized the ecclesial status of the Eastern churches, defined and defended the particular identity within the Roman communion. They are placed on a footing of equality with the churches of Western or Latin tradition. All the churches of the East and the West are equally entrusted to the pastoral guidance of the Roman pontiff. Of course, what that implies fully will only be clear when, with the progress made of Catholic Orthodox dialogue. But certainly, there is no doubt that the Roman Pontiff, the Pope, has a very special responsibility for towards all the churches, including the Eastern churches. They are of equal dignity, and this is important to bear in mind, because in the past it has been forgotten, so that none of them is superior to the others by reason of right. There is a special historical reason for making this point. The Council wished to definitively eliminate any idea of a prestantia ritus Latini, or a superiority of the Latin rite over all others, as being the rite of the Holy Roman Church, as had been proclaimed by no less a person than Pope Benedict XIV in his constitution Etsi Pastoralis of 1742, addressed to the Italo-Albanians, which for centuries has been a cause of humiliation to Eastern Rite faithful, giving them the status of Catholics of the second rank. At the same time, the conciliar statement made clear the distinction between the Pope's position as primate or senior bishop of the Latin Church and head of the Latin tradition, and his universal supra-ritual primacy. The second paragraph of the decree goes far in describing the Holy Catholic Church as a communion of churches. It speaks of different groups of faithful which are held together by the hierarchy and so form particular churches or rites. It is interesting to note that these two words are used and are made almost equivalent, church and rite. But it is normal to identify a church by the rite of worship, the kind of worship it practices. And in the past, Roman documents, instead of referring to churches, would refer to communities of the Eastern Rite, even those provided with a hierarchy and so are fully fledged as churches, often refer to them as rites. The tendency today, and in this document where you have a transitional phraseology, the custom is to speak simply of churches and to reserve the word rite only to the liturgical elements of church life. And this means that the church is made up of different groups, each with their own traditions, each with their own characteristics, forms of worship, canon law, and so on. This variety within the church, the council, the decree states, in no way harms her unity, but rather manifests it. The unity that marks the church is not one of uniformity. This unity is the work of the Holy Spirit, present and active in all the churches as in all the faithful, and who, in the diversity of spiritual gifts, also promotes the exchange and sharing of these same gifts. The decree proudly proclaims between these churches, the decree is referring to the Catholic Communion, there flourishes such an admirable brotherhood that this variety in no way harms but enhances the unity of the holy churches of God in such a way that if one church or rite is diminished, then the entire body is impoverished. That is why the decree goes on to state, it is the mind of the Catholic Church that each individual church or rite retain its traditions whole and entire, while adjusting its way of life to the various needs of time and place. From this are drawn certain directives for the preservation and growth of each individual church, among which the necessity of providing adequate pastoral care, including, where necessary, the establishment of a hierarchy for the faithful of the Eastern churches, wherever they are to be found, and the need for inter-ecclesial consultation and cooperation where there are overlapping jurisdictions. A special directive concerns non-Catholics, especially Orientals, entering into the fullness of Catholic communion. They are to retain their own right, cherish it, and observe it to the best of their ability. And we have cases in Malta of Orthodox who marry Maltese and who are tempted, let me say, to change into the Latin rite. The Church does not desire this, but would like them to stay, to be faithful to their own tradition. The decree, then, again reaffirms its high esteem for the Eastern churches and their traditions, and unhesitatingly, it states, it looks upon it as the heritage of Christ's universal church. But it also draws an important conclusion. It solemnly declares that the churches of the East, as much as of the West, fully enjoy the right and are in duty bound to rule or govern themselves. Each should do so according to its proper and individual procedures, inasmuch as practices sanctioned by a noble antiquity harmonizes better with the customs of the faithful and are seen as more likely to foster the good of souls. This is a big statement, and although ambiguities, relation between the center and the universal pastoral solicitude of the Roman pontiff and the local churches, to what extent does this limit or favor the affirmation of self-government, or, as the Orthodox would say, autocephaly? This is a problem which still has to be worked out. So the document here is not clear enough, needs to be made much more precise. It is being been made a little more precise, but very slowly, in our Catholic Orthodox theological dialogue. Although ambiguities are still present, it cannot but have an impact on Catholic Orthodox theological dialogue. It cannot be said that the ideal of ecclesiastical self-rule has been realized in the Eastern Catholic churches, and it may be that these still require, in fact, require a good dose of Roman intervention and support. So there are reasons also for papal intervention. It is important, however, that the spiritual heritage of the Eastern churches is preserved for the good of the church as a whole, because that is part of the church's total patrimony, which must be preserved in its entirety. The responsibility for its preservation incomes, first of all, on the Orientals themselves. Easterners themselves, the decree says, should honor all these things with the greatest fidelity. Besides, they should acquire an ever greater knowledge and a more exact use of them. It is a sad fact that in the course of time, because of historical circumstances and coexistence with communities of the Western tradition, the Eastern Catholic churches have, to a great or lesser extent, come under strong Latin or Western influence and have been subjected to, or themselves have favored, a process of Latinization. To this, the Holy See has responded long before Vatican II with efforts to promote among the Eastern churches a return to their genuine traditions and to liberate them from accretions both unnecessary and ill-advised. In this perspective, the decree makes a point of calling upon the pastoral operators, as one may call them as a whole, who, by reason of their office, are in frequent contact with the Eastern churches or their faithful. They are to be carefully trained to know and respect the rites, discipline, doctrine, history, and characteristics of Eastern Christians. This is most applicable to our missionaries and lay volunteers preparing to serve in countries and regions of Eastern Christian tradition. It is, besides, good missionary strategy always to adapt to local conditions and to demand no more than is necessary in the Lord's way. Among the elements that refer to self-government, autocephaly, self-rule, the duty to rule themselves, one institution receives special treatment, the Patriarchate. The decree recognizes the special status of the Eastern Patriarch, a title not simply honorific. It insists on the antiquity of the institutions as having existed in the church from the earliest times, recognized by the first ecumenical synods. A patriarch is a bishop who has a jurisdiction over other bishops, including metropolitans, clergy, and people in a given wide territory. He is freely elected according to recognized procedures and acts always with his synod. His power is never absolute, never monarchic. It is always exercised synodically. The Council declares that in keeping with the most ancient tradition of the Church, the patriarchs of the Eastern Churches are to be accorded exceptional respect, since each presides over his patriarchate as father and head. So it's much more than a juridical dimension. There is, in the word itself, patriarchate, a strong suggestion that he is a father and that he is a head. It calls for the re-establishment of patriarchal rights and privileges, and declares that these rights and privileges, it doesn't define them, but it does say that these rights and privileges are those which flourished when East and West were in union, that is, to return to the situation of the first millennium, which is what the Catholic Orthodox Theological Commission is at present doing. This is a momentous statement of incalculable importance to East-West Catholic Orthodox theological dialogue, and still has to await full implementation. Some ecclesiologists have also wondered whether something of the patriarchal institution could not be transposed into the institution of episcopal conferences, so that there would be more decentralization and more responsibilization of the national or regional episcopates. Other matters treated in the decree are practical dispositions regarding sacramental discipline and divine worship, or the liturgy, and finally, relations with brethren of the Orthodox churches. This last question is of particular interest. Eastern Catholics are held to have a special duty and mission to promote Christian unity, even though, as uniates, as they are called, we can go into this title later perhaps if you wish, they may be distrusted and considered as wolves in sheep's clothing, considered generally by Orthodox as being an obstacle, a complication, rather than a bridge and a facilitation in Catholic Orthodox dialogue of truth and love. They are bound, however, strictly to promote the cause of unity, whatever the cost. And this the Council specifies by prayer, then by the example of their lives, by religious fidelity to ancient Christian traditions, by greater mutual knowledge, by collaboration, and by a brotherly regard for objects such as icons and other objects familiar to Orthodox, and attitudes. The decree, very importantly, allows for a milder way of acting in sacramental sharing or intercommunion, out of concern for spiritual good, spiritual necessity, and the good of souls. And now I invite you to ask for clarifications or to put questions on this very interesting not the most important document, not the most important of the conciliar documents, but still it has its own importance, especially on the pastoral plane. Yes?
How many Eastern Rite churches are there?
Yes. Well, it is possible to say, but offhand I can say that the Eastern Catholic churches are can be divided according to ritual appurtenance, according to rite, and there are, I think, seven major rites. Some rites do not have branches, but most of them do have separate multiple branches. The Armenian, for example, church, you have the Armenian Apostolic Church, which is to be found chiefly in Armenia itself, with a presence in Georgia and in Turkey, and of course in Western countries where there is a diaspora. The majority of Armenians are Orthodox. When I say Orthodox, not Orthodox like the others, you have Orthodox who did not accept the definitions of the Council of Chalcedon in 451. And the Armenian Church is one of the churches which separated from the communion of the Catholic Orthodox Church in the middle of the 5th century. Most of the Armenians, wherever they are to be found, are Orthodox, but there is a small Armenian Catholic Church also, which has its center in Antelias in Lebanon. Catholic Armenians have a bishop in Greece, in France, and in North and South America. But that is relatively simple. The Byzantine Church, well, it is composed of the four ancient patriarchates, that is Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, and of the modern patriarchs, beginning with the Patriarchate of Moscow, which was founded in the 16th century. The Patriarchate of Moscow is numerically the largest Orthodox community, with about 150 million faithful, both in Russia, and Russia is an immense territory, in Eastern Europe and in the Americas. In addition to the Patriarchate of Moscow, you have the patriarchates created at the end of the 19th century with the rise of national states in Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, and Georgia, of course, is a very ancient patriarchate, but it had been suppressed for a long time when Russia occupied Armenia at the beginning of the 19th century. It brought the Georgian Church under the jurisdiction of the Patriarchate of Moscow, so that the Georgian Church lost its autocephaly, or self-rule, autonomy, full autonomy. But with the reemergence of the Orthodox Church, after the great drama of the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet regime, the Georgian Church recovered its patriarchate, and it is a very important patriarchate, and we have in Malta a community of Georgians who are very keen on having a priest of their own church to come and serve them. In addition to these, you have the Patriarchate of Romania. Now, Romania was until the 18th century, until the end of the second half of the 19th century, was under the jurisdiction of the Patriarchate of Constantinople, which then was under Ottoman regime. But with the rise of the national state, then it became a patriarchate. Now, the Romanian, the Romanian Church of Byzantine Rite is composed of the largely dominant, you know, Orthodox Church with its patriarchate centered on Bucharest, and a Greek Catholic or an Eastern Church community in full communion with Rome, which has its center in Transylvania, in western Romania, in that part of Romania which had been in the past part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And that is how the union did come about, because the circumstances favored a certain union. You have within the Patriarchate of Moscow two churches which are not fully autocephalous, but they have their own autonomy, as they call it. The difference between autocephaly and autonomy is that the head of an autonomous church is consecrated by the, or has to be confirmed at least, by the patriarch of the mother church. Now, in the case of Ukraine and Belorussia, both these churches, Ukrainian Orthodox Church and Belorussian Orthodox Church, have autonomous status but are closely linked to the Patriarchate of Moscow. They share the same heritage. But in the Ukraine, you also have a number of other churches who are divided among themselves. You have a very important Greek Catholic Church with its center in Lvov, or Lviv, as it is said in Ukrainian, but with a bishop also in Kiev, for example. So this the creation of a diocese in Kiev, or the transfer of the assumption of the title of Kiev, was resented by the Orthodox. In addition to that, you have the Ukrainian Ukrainian Orthodox autocephalous patriarchate, which does not have canonical status and is not recognized by other churches. And you have a Ukrainian Orthodox patriarch Filaret, who broke communion at a certain moment for various reasons in Kiev. And he was destituted for, chiefly for moral reasons, but he maintained himself and has a following. He has assumed a highly nationalistic policy, perhaps for out of a certain opportunism. In addition to that, you have the Bulgarian Orthodox Church. Of course, most people in Bulgaria are Orthodox, but there is a small Greek Catholic community, the result of Catholic missions at the end of the 19th century. Catholic missions run by the Lazarists and by the Assumptionists, but on a basis of a certain embryonic movement of unity within Bulgaria itself, and in fact which started in the Bulgarian monastery of Mount Athos. One of the reasons why they were attracted to Catholicism was because of frequent communion in the Catholic churches. That's rather interesting to remark. The Ukrainian Catholic Church has a presence in Galicia, and in Volhynia, that is in western Ukraine, in Subcarpathian Russia, that is in the Carpathian region, in eastern Slovakia, and also in Hungary. They are all the fruit of a union, an ecclesiastical union, which was entered into in 1595. A union inspired by the Council of Florence, held in 1439. Its principles and declarations were taken from the Florentine Council and Florentine Act of Union. And the Carpatho-Russians came into the union in 1646. Now, in all these countries, you have the Orthodox Church and the Greek Catholic Church living side by side, not always very peaceably. One of the problems following the liberalization in the ex-Soviet Russia, one of the problems was the redistribution of church buildings and church properties. That was a cause of much friction. This was supposed to have been regulated by mutual consultation by four different bodies, the Vatican, the Greek Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, in a spirit of brotherhood, but that was not possible. Unfortunately. The Greek Catholics of Ukrainian, Western Ukrainian extraction are also very well established in Canada and in the United States. Now, in addition to these countries in Eastern Europe, you have a small Eastern Rite Byzantine Rite Church in the Near East. You have the three patriarchates still active, Orthodox patriarchates, Antioch, Alexandria, and Jerusalem. Now, Alexandria is the most senior of these three. Alexandria is centered on Alexandria in Egypt, but there are not many Orthodox, that is Chalcedonian Orthodox, living in Egypt. But the Orthodox Church has carried out a number of very successful missions throughout Africa. And so there are today Orthodox churches fully fledged with bishop, with a hierarchy and so on, in made up of faithful who are Africans, pure Africans. And the liturgy has been translated into several African languages, and this is very interesting. So today, the Patriarchate of Alexandria has become very much a mission patriarchate with a great future, perhaps, on the African continent. The Church of Antioch is essentially Arabic in character. It has assumed its full responsibility in the Arab world and claims to be the Arabic Church. It celebrates in Arabic, although it uses Greek on special occasions, but it is Arabic and has assumed all the political aspirations of the Arab peoples. Unfortunately, it is at the moment under very great pressure as a result of this civil war which is going on in Syria. And the Bishop of Aleppo, where there was a flourishing community, his house and his church was ransacked by the rebels, and he had to leave Syria. He is now in Lebanon. The Greek Catholic, not the Orthodox Patriarch. The Orthodox community has still held, and no doubt it is under pressure, as the Catholics. At one time, immediately after the council, there were great hopes of cooperation, of collaboration between the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate of Antioch and the Greek Catholic Patriarchate of Antioch. And a number of projects were launched, for example, producing identical common translations of the liturgy, the liturgical books, common catechetical material, and so on. But it hasn't gone very far. And at the moment, the situation is rather somewhat paralyzed because of the problems facing all these churches in the Middle East. But the fact that there are problems which all Christians have to face has made it that there is regular consultation, at least for matters relating to relations with the particular states, have made it necessary for a regular consultation to be held. This has also taken place in Jerusalem, where there are a number of hierarchies, and you have the Latin Patriarchate, which was created by Pio IX in the middle of the 19th century, and the historic Orthodox Patriarchate, and then you have the Melkite Patriarch, who, although he lives in Damascus, but he carries also the title of Jerusalem. Now, in Jerusalem, the question is very special because the Patriarchate itself has an international character, a cosmopolitan character, and is made up not only of Greeks, but of many other people who make up the fraternity of the Holy Sepulchre, and they are the ones who are responsible for the central administration. But the faithful and the parish clergy, the rural clergy, is all Arabic. And there should be more Arab speaking. All the bishops are Arab speaking, because even though they are Greeks, they have been living in the Holy Land for a long time, and they made a point of learning Arabic, so they have no difficulty in this respect. But it would be desirable that there are more Arab bishops, ethnically Arab. Only that the Arabic clergy, Arabic Orthodox clergy, is practically all married, and so they cannot qualify for the episcopate. Yes.
From what you've said in answer to the previous question, one can see the problems, not just with the Orthodox, but even within existing Catholic
clergy. Of course.
My question is this. There's two problems. In the Vatican, because this is a hell of a problem to coordinate at the papal level, is there a dicaster for these churches to coordinate things? And secondly, how do you view the problems of the Coptics in Egypt, who are a minority, and the Maronites in Lebanon?
Well, as regards the Vatican administration, the Congregation for the Oriental Churches was founded by Benedict the 15th in 1917. Benedict the 15th founded the Oriental Congregation and also the Pontifical Oriental Institute more or less contemporaneously. Previous to that, there was a Pius the 9th had created an Oriental section within Propaganda Fide. Now, the Congregation for the Oriental Churches has is competent to deal with all matters connected with the Eastern Catholic Churches, but exclusively Eastern Catholic Churches. That is to say, the ecumenical dimension is not dealt with by the Congregation for the Oriental Churches. That is dealt with by the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. Now, as regards the Maronites, they are a community which does not have an Orthodox counterpart. All the Maronites are in full communion with the Roman See. and they have been in communion since the Crusades. Although they did sign an act of union in the Council of Florence later, that was simply a confirmation of previous practice. Administratively, and as regards ecclesial concern, their position is no different from that of other Eastern Christian churches. One must remember that today the Secretariat of State has increased its power and its intervention, so all that concerns the public order, the political situation, etc., is dealt with by the Secretariat of State. So that the Congregation for the Oriental Churches is concerned with almost all matters, but in supervising or religious life, religious renewal, seminaries, also important, I must say, is the financial aid which the Congregation for Oriental Churches also offers to the Oriental Churches as a whole, because as you know, they do not command much material resources, and there are continually buildings, churches, schools, which are continually being destroyed and have to be rebuilt and so on. That is really the position.
What is the switch from the subject. What is the position of celibacy between the Greek Catholic and the Eastern Catholic Church?
Yes. Well, the position is this, that there is an Eastern discipline which the Catholic Church solemnly, in ecumenical council, has engaged itself to maintain and observe. So this is the position. When these churches, whether it was the Melkite or the Maronite or Armenian or Coptic or Ethiopian, etc., decided, but elements of these churches decided or looked for communion with the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church did not impose clerical celibacy. It allowed them to carry on with their own traditional discipline. And it is considered as a very honorable to belong to a priestly family. And there are families which have generations and generations of priests they can look back on. And they have a very important role to play. And they are, in general, very exemplary. They are persons who have great experience in family problems and who show great pastoral concern and solicitude. So it's the only church which does not have clerical celibacy as part of its discipline is the Syro-Malabar Church in India. And that is the result of the impositions by the colonializing Portuguese Padroado, as it is called, patronage over the eastern countries. This is a very unfortunate, a very sad episode in church history.
You mentioned Antioch.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, there are two Antiochs, one in Pisidia.
Yes, and yes. Yeah, there are several.
Antiochia,
yes.
Which we call it in Syria.
Yes.
But if I'm not mistaken again,
yes.
Antiochia now is a part of
Turkey.
Of Turkey,
yes.
And not like Aleppo.
Yes, you are right. The patriarchs, Catholic and Orthodox, carry the title of Antioch. Yes. But Antioch itself, Antakya, is in southeastern Turkey. Yes. There is another Antioch in Pisidia and other Antiochs, but I can't think of them all now. But the important one was Antioch on the Orontes, the river Orontes, which was the capital of the Roman diocese, which is the immense administrative territory of the Orient. That is why the Patriarch of Antioch carries as his full title, Patriarch of Antioch and all the Orient, because the Patriarchate was extended to the Euphrates and had no strict limits in the East. But both the prefect of the diocese, which was the administrative unit, and the Patriarch, the chief bishop, carried the title of Antioch and the Orient, and all the Orient.
Until some time back, the Pope had also the title of Patriarch of Rome.
So yes.
For the second movement, what was the significance of that title and why was it removed?
I don't understand why it was removed, because it had been accepted for centuries, and it was it appeared all the time in the Annuario Pontificio from the very first moment of its publication, which means early in the 19th century. And there is no way of denying that the Pope has a special status and a special responsibility with regard to the Western tradition. So he does exercise, same as Oriental patriarchs, for the Latin Rite, for the churches of Latin Rite, he is a kind of father and head. Now, the important thing to remember is that the Pope, as Bishop of Rome, exercises a pastoral authority at several levels. Naturally, the various levels today, with the passage of time, are rather confused. Metropolitan of the Roman province, Primate of Italy, and in the past it was said Patriarch of the West. In fact, the Pope, as such, as Bishop of Rome, has no business with deciding questions of, for example, Eastern liturgy. He is simply not qualified. It is outside of his competence, and it is not necessary that he should be competent in Eastern or Ethiopian liturgy. You must distinguish between the Pope's authority as belonging to a cultural as well as ecclesial unity, conditioned by its history and its development, at least for the last 1,000 years, and his position as a primate of the Universal Church, as Edelby, Archbishop Edelby, said, and I quoted, the Pope is neither at the highest level, is neither East nor West.
Can you enlighten us, please, on the main stumbling block?
Well, the main stumbling block today is the Roman primacy. It needs to be defined in a way that it becomes acceptable to all. Both parties are agreed that we have to return to the relations which were in force in the first millennium. And so there is a lot of research going on. This requires a lot of historical research, patristic research, to establish exactly how these two centers of supra powers, yes, can be interrelated. The center, if you can call it center, is center to a certain extent. Certainly, I think Orthodox are all agreed that within the community, within the college of bishops, that is in the sphere of episcopal collegiality, the Bishop of Rome has a primacy, but they say a primacy of honor. He is primus inter pares. In point of fact, in the first millennium, we have examples when the popes intervened in the life of local churches, partly because they had received an appeal, or partly because the situation was simply out of hand. They were called to participate and to give the authority of the Roman Church, not simply the Roman bishop, but the Roman Church as such, which is the product of the martyrdom of Peter and Paul, not only Peter but also Paul, had the highest authority. That is why the Council of Chalcedon called on Pope Leo to intervene and to give his authoritative opinion on the Christological question, and it was accepted. But whether this proves that the Pope has a power of ordinary jurisdiction is a very different thing.
Ringrazio Hafna o Hafna del Monsignor Mifsud Montanaro al del lecture veramente frisk, verament miftuh, u li tana idea spektrum tal-istoria tal-Knejjes Orientali u d-dottrina, eccetera, eccetera. Prosit, mill-ġdejtu, grazzi, ħafna.